Hello and welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open-access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. In this monthly podcast, we look at highlights from the latest advances in stem cell research appearing in the journal. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they've tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thanks for listening in. This episode is sponsored by Biotechne. We'll hear more about them later on in the episode. Autism spectrum disorder, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. These are just a few of the hundreds of neuropsychiatric disorders that impact the mental and behavioral health of millions of individuals around the world. These diverse and complex brain disorders contribute to significant morbidity and mortality. They're challenging to understand and treat, due in part to their biological complexity and due to the challenges of modeling the many facets of these conditions in animals. More recent scientific advances in stem cell research, though, have allowed new insight into these disorders. Previously inaccessible aspects of human brain development can now be modeled using induced pluripotent stem cells and three-dimensional models of brain development like organoids. The genome of the cultured cells can be more easily and precisely edited with target approaches like CRISPR to introduce mutations that confer susceptibility to neuropsychiatric disorders. While there's still much to be learned, these approaches offer hope that science may gain new insight into the causes and potential treatments for these devastating diseases. Our guests today are experts on the brain and modeling brain disorders, and they both published extensively on this topic. Joining me today are Drs. Carol Marchetto and Rusty Gage. Carol is an assistant professor in the anthropology department at the University of California, San Diego, and an adjunct assistant professor at the Salk Institute. She's also the senior author of a recent review in Stem Cell Reports entitled Reaching into the Toolbox, Stem Cell Models to Study Neuropsychiatric Disorders. Rusty Gage is the Vi and John Adler Chair for Research on Age-Related Neurodegenerative Disease and the president of the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. He's received numerous awards and recognitions for his research, including his appointment as a fellow of the National Academy of Medicine. Rusty's also a former president of the ISSCR and a current member of the Stem Cell Reports editorial board. Welcome to you both, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us, Martin. Nice to be here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Carol, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with neuropsychiatric disorders, can you give us a kind of brief overview of their impact on global health?
So in general terms, a neuropsychiatric condition is part of a group of mental disorders that are characterized by clinically significant disturbance in an individual's cognition, emotional regulation, or behavior. It is usually associated with distress or impairment in important areas of functioning. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that in 2019, one in every eight people, or about 970 million people around the world, are living with a mental disorder, with anxiety and depressive disorders as the most common. In 2020, this number has significantly increased because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Recent estimates show over 20% increase in some of specific conditions in just 1 year. And this is huge. While effective prevention and treatment options exist, most people with mental disorders do not have access to effective care. And many people also experience stigma, discrimination, and violations of human rights. So there is a lot of impact in our society.
And a lot of work to do, obviously. Rusty, over your career, you've really studied diverse aspects of brain development, such as neurogenesis. You've studied aging and even evolution of the central nervous system. So how did you first get interested in the neurosciences? And today, what are the specific goals of your research?
Well, that's interesting. So how did I originally get interested in neurosciences? It goes back quite a ways. But I think what struck me early on in my undergraduate degree work was brain plasticity. I was struck by how perturbations of the central nervous system, damage to the central nervous system, results in rewiring. And you know, you're asking me historically. I began working on epilepsy models and was struck by how after epileptic episodes, there is potential rewiring going on. That the fact that the brain had that plasticity to rewire suggested that it may not only be rewiring for the bad, but could be trained to rewire for the good. So that's been a theme for me really throughout my career, really, my life, is how can we harness the energies of the intrinsic properties of the brain to affect reorganization and enhance neuroplasticity.
Great, thank you. Carol.
And I would say, just to follow up the second part of your question, is that while we have made substantial progress over the last 50 years in this domain of neuroplasticity, it is still very much a recognized but untapped area of investigation. But with the new tools that you've been alluding to, I think there's great hope and optimism for even a greater amount of ability to do this. And it's not all cellular molecular manipulations, but we know that the environment plays an enormous role in this. So I think we can dig into what Carol's talking about, a toolbox to enhance plasticity as well.
Great. Carol, tell us a little bit about your scientific background and how you got interested in this area.
I started my career in Brazil at University of São Paulo, did my PhD with Dr. Carlos Mink, working with cellular models for a rare genetic condition called xeroderma pigmentosum. These patients have mutations in enzymes that participate in DNA repair lesions caused by exposure to UV light. With time, these individuals accumulate too many unrepaired lesions in their skin, and that causes mutations that lead to elevated rates of skin cancer. What intrigued me then was that some of the patients also had mental health issues, even though there was no way that UV was going into their brains to cause lesions there. So while this question is still not completely understood in the field, it did spark my interest in neuroscience and prompted me to look for labs that had the tools to study human neurogenesis or human brain development using cellular systems. And obviously, Rusty Gage lab came to mind. It was Rusty's one of the pioneers on the studies of neurogenesis. And when I joined the lab back in 2005 as a postdoc, stem cell work was just becoming more accessible in California, in part because of Proposition 71, or the California Stem Cell Research and Cures Act. It was passed in 2004. And that enabled stem cell work in the state and the creation of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. In 2006 and 2007, when Takashi Yamanaka published their seminal manuscript introducing the iPS technology, which I first heard from Yamanaka during a 2006 ISSCR meeting, I saw the opportunity of finally model neurodevelopmental and neuropsychiatric conditions using patient-derived stem cells. And of course, Rusty was also very excited with it. So this hasn't been possible until that discovery because of the polygenic nature of many psychiatry conditions. We are now able to have patient-tailored lines to study live neuronal behavior in conditions such as bipolar disorder, major depression, and schizophrenia, autism. So that has changed the game.
You're a classic case of someone who turned up in the right place at the right time, Carol. Rusty, one of the challenges in using these stem cell-derived models such as organoids is that they typically reflect fetal stages of development. And this is, of course, an issue for many applications of disease modeling with stem cells, including modeling of these mental health disorders that often appear after puberty or later on in life. In your view, to what extent can we regard some of these severe neuropsychiatric conditions, like autism or schizophrenia, as developmental disorders? And to a comment you made earlier, what role does the postnatal environment play?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right that the model system that you choose, even the cellular model system you choose, is really going to be limit what you can investigate. So using the iPS cells, that is embryonic stem cell derived cells that then progress through its early phases of neuroprogenitors and then onto neurons, we can examine that area in really great detail at the cellular molecular level. But if the perturbation or the, let's say, the initiating event is occurring quite postnatal, then it's going to be very difficult for us to pinpoint the origins of the molecular event that lead to it. On the other hand, what we found, and I think which is really occurring in some of these psychiatric diseases, that the initiating event is actually occurring prenatally. And this has been not only work from our lab, but also others like Dan Geschwind and Paolo Arlotta and others there are mapping back to early events. And that really works to the strength of the iPS-derived cells because it allows them to really map in quite detail when an inflection point may have occurred. Now, that's the cell molecular part of it. It may not manifest itself in a person until they're postnatal and they're born and you see them. But what we're able to do in vitro is to look at the molecular events that are initiating for it. So I think that on the other hand, if you have a real postnatal initiating event, it's unrelated to this set of experiments, we have a sort of a different approach to it. And by using another methodology, which is direct reprogramming, you can take a fibroblast from a patient and directly drive them into a neuronal phenotype. And if you do that, you can capture the epigenetic state of that cell from the epigenetic state of it that it was from the fibroblast. So you really have a an age matched to the fibroblast, and then you can monitor more of what their landscape is for their molecular state at that time. What you will miss, though, in doing that direct reprogramming are the early events. So there's a trade-off in both cases, and we're grateful that we have both tools in our toolbox.
Yeah, and I'm actually optimistic that we'll learn how to mature these cells much better as time goes along.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Carol, in a recent podcast, we spoke with Taka Takebe from Cincinnati, who actually works on liver organoids, and he identified modeling of communication within and between tissues as a major challenge in his work. Can you envision these model systems one day being able to replicate disruptions to functional connectivity across brain regions that are thought to be important in schizophrenia?
Yeah, so this is a challenge in the field, and many researchers are actually putting a lot of effort in trying to improve connectivity in the organoid system. So some labs, such as Sergio Pasha, are making a lot of progress in fusioning organoids with different brain regions, specific cell types. And that has recapitulated some aspects of neuronal migration, neuronal maturation, targeting, axon targeting, synapsogenesis. Nonetheless, as you point in the question, and as your other guest, Taka Takebe, also pointed, there's still much, much more room for optimization in these models. In the review, we have discussed some important areas where more optimization would be beneficial for improving neuronal functioning, activity, and connectivity within organoid models. So one example would be to improve area optimization, to induce vascularization of organoids, to increase neuronal survival, as well as maturation. You can achieve that by implanting human organoids into rodent brain, as Rusty Gage Lab has shown in the past, or also by engineering endogenous vascular-like networks. Another room for optimization is to increase the ratio of other cells in the niche that are supportive to neuronal functions, such as astrocytes, pericytes, microglia, that can promote functional blood-brain barrier systems that support the neurostem cell populations and circuits. There's also room for optimization in supporting the enrichment of the maturation of astrocytes that can improve synapse regulation. And also adding myelinating oligodendrocytes, because right now all of the neurons that we can make in organoids are unmyelinated. And adding a potential of myelination can definitely improve electrical transmission. And introducing microglia, as I mentioned before, will allow researchers to study microglial behavior and inflammation in neuropsychiatric disease, which is well known to have an impact. So those are some areas that could improve.
So these sound like some big goals for second and third generation models. But on the other hand, I find this field is moving incredibly quickly. So I'm actually pretty optimistic about it. And as we talk about more sophisticated models, Rusty, some of this research is trying to understand the higher order functions of the brain. And there are ethical issues around the research, especially as the techniques enable longer-term growth and maturation of organoids and their connectivity, whether in culture or in the xenotransplant models that you described. Is it sensible to be concerned about human brain organoids becoming, in a sense, sentient? Or is this idea of a brain in a vat really a thought experiment for philosophers rather than scientists to talk about?
Yeah, I would refer you to an excellent report by the National Academy of Sciences on organoids and chimeras that was published last year, and it's free for downloading from the National Academy of Sciences website. In this year-long study, I was part of the study. It was headed by several Academy members, and it was quite an interesting array. We invited many religious leaders and philosophers, social scientists, animal rights activists to give their views on this and try to think about all the different perspectives that we could possibly have. We had legal experts as well, you know, saying, where are we legally on this? Then where are we philosophically? Where are we on religious grounds? And there is not, I mean, I think the conclusion was that the current regulations that require, certainly in the United States, using IACUC and other internal advisory groups are very important, and they're doing a good job, but they need to be examined every year to make sure that the advances that are being made in the technology match with the oversight that is there. And I think this is part of what you're saying, is it's not that I think we're not doing a good job, it's just we have to be very diligent. We have to keep on it. And I would also say that this is not a new issue. I mean, we've been, neuroscience is certainly, we've been dealing with the issue of xenografts for quite a while. As a biological tool goes, my involvement goes back into the late 70s, early 80s, when we were transplanting human fetal tissue into rodent models of Parkinson's disease to prepare for these clinical trials that came up later. And lots of discussions about these issues. They do change as culture changes. And so the questions morph a bit, and the society changes as well. And we as scientists need to be in tune with the society and not necessarily ensconced in our own perspectives on things, and certainly not from a temporal point of view. We need to move with the times. And so it's not a done deal. We got to continue to do it. We have to read. We have to discuss this openly with colleagues. And I would say the last point is that this is an opportunity for science to reach out and communicate science and how we do science to the public. This is a real, rather than feeling it as a threat, think of it as an opportunity.
That is just a terrific set of thoughts for young investigators in this field. And what you just described applies to a field I'm closer to, which is human embryo modeling, which is advancing very quickly, as you're both aware. And we just have to keep on top of it, and we have to keep the conversation with the public open. So we're going to take a quick break now, and when we get back, we'll continue our discussion on the brain and its functions.
Basement membrane extract, or BME, is used globally for stem cell, organoid, and other 3D cell culture applications. When choosing a BME for 2D or 3D cell culture, key considerations usually include matrix composition, protein concentration, tensile strength, and consistency in performance in order to limit time-consuming batch-to-batch testing. Today, Biotechne is proud to introduce Cultrex Ultimatrix BME, our ultimate basement membrane extract for organoid and 3D culture. Why not find out more at biotechne.com/researchareas/stemcell and secure your BME supply today.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. We've been talking with Drs. Carol Marchetto and Rusty Gage about brain development and the study of neuropsychiatric disorders. Carol, psychiatric diseases are more than the development, connectivity, and function of brain cells in the laboratory. These disorders have complex social components that can be difficult to study, let alone model. And yet there are scientists using fruit flies, fish, and mice to try and understand these aspects. What, for your own research, what do you see as the next steps in building on what you've done so far?
As you pointed out, psychiatric conditions are very complex and have many, many components. Our approach has been to study one aspect at a time using scientific method and testing hypotheses. In this net sense, any model that can represent one of the many components of the psychiatric condition being studied can be and has been extremely valuable. So we've been trying to isolate different components and studying them separated. And eventually, we can bring some of this study together and also from the literature. And that has bringing more clinicians to the table has also helping has been helping a lot in defining and helping with defining that multiplicity of aspects that a psychiatric condition has. So with that, we've been able to look into patient cohorts that were, for instance, responsive or non-responsive to a certain drug. And we were able to model that into the dish. So use cell culture systems, for instance, with using bipolar patient samples that were responders or non-responders to lithium treatment, and we can see a response in the dish. So we can model that aspect now. So with closer connections and discussions with clinicians and understanding how there is a subdivision of patients and subcohorts, we are able to make some progress lately.
That's great. And that sort of leads into my next question. Do you think we'll be able to develop really robust methods for drug discovery based on these models? And is the pharmaceutical industry buying into that yet?
Over the past 10 years, we have had interactions and collaborations with many big pharma companies that were interested in exploring some of the cellular models we developed, such as, for instance, as I mentioned before, bipolar and schizophrenia. Of course, there are challenges, and some of the challenges are to develop these models up to a robustness that the pharmaceutical company can use them. And that has traditionally have involved reproducibility because of the heterogeneity in patient populations and scalability for the more automated systems. But we're making some progress on these areas too.
Great. So Rusty, to push an extreme point of view that some of my systems genetics colleagues might ask you about, do you think that one day we can reduce the modeling of these neuropsychiatric disorders to the study of perturbations in gene regulatory networks in cultured cells?
I do. I mean, that's motivation in part behind what we're doing. I would highlight Carol's statement about stratifying patients is a very effective mechanism to understand more deeply the circuitry underlying the cells that are, say, responsive to lithium versus not. We also did the same thing for depression. We had a large cohort of individuals that were taken off drug, and then all of them were put back on a single serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and then they put into bimodal populations of those that were good responders and those were bad responders. And with that, we can take the tail ends of the population and look mechanistically inside and see what are the pathways. Why do some patients respond and some patients not respond? And just fundamentally, could we develop a diagnostic where you could stratify, you could test patients ahead of time and find out whether or not they predictively would be responsive to medication? Because in some cases, it takes months, if not years, of treatment before you actually know that they're non-responsive. And that period of time could be eliminated if you had this predictive mechanism. And that can only be done if you have a circuit molecular system that's understood that distinguishes between these patients.
It's good to hear that optimism. Carol, I'm going to finish up with the last question for you. We have a lot of listeners who are graduate students and postdocs who are contemplating the next step in their careers. And maybe you could tell us how your time at the Salk prepared you for running your own lab and what impact did Rusty and his mentorship have on your approach to science?
My time as a staff scientist at the Salk Institute at Rusty Gates Lab was invaluable for my career. It gave me the opportunity to focus on science and share the leadership of projects with Rusty. In that position, I was also very fortunate to be able to mentor students and postdocs and write grants without the same type of pressure that an early career investigator would have. While I'm definitely feeling the pressure now that I'm starting my new position at UCSD, I believe that I am much better prepared for the challenge. And I also wanted to say something about Rusty's mentorship. So his mentorship over the years, I still have his mentorship that didn't end. We have worked together for many years, and that has been instrumental for my career. His contagious passion for discovery and commitment to be responsive and available to students and postdocs is inspiring to me to this day, even when he is extremely busy as the president of the Salk, for instance. And I do hope I can be inspiring to my student in similar ways. I just also wanted to make a quick point of what we, for the review that we have published in Stem Cell Reports. This was actually a sanity check for all of us during the pandemic, because all the people that were my students and people that were working with me and people that had left the lab, we're all cooped up at home, and we are used to go to the lab, do a lot of experiments, and all of a sudden we couldn't go anywhere. So the way in which we tried to make ourselves sane was to write this review and have weekly meetings that we discussed, and we talked about science and methods and things that we were actually working on. I would say that in part, thanks to that, we're all in somewhat stable mental state now. So,
well, that's a wonderful thing to hear. It was a great review. You've obviously had a great opportunity and you've really made the most of it. So well done, and best of luck to you both with your research. That's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thank you for listening.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access peer-reviewed society journal. For scientists, by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.